Ever wonder why 95% of leads do not convert? Why cold call rates are down and prospects don't open our emails? Why our responses of robocalls and implanting pixels to track user interaction, mostly without permission, is backfiring spectacularly? Well, that's what we intend to find out here in the Buyerside Chat podcast. There are scores of podcasts about selling, but most miss the shift that has come upon the buying-selling process. The initiative has since moved from the supply to the demand side. The Buyerside Chat, your podcast of record for B2B buying, talks to actual buyers, persons, not personas, in the quest to understand the real buyer's journey, their trials and tribulations, challenges and outcomes they're striving for. Welcome to the Buyerside Chat. Thank you for your time and for joining us on this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. I personally look at each comment and will give a shout out to each of you in our next episodes. It means a lot to hear from you. Today we have with us Arun Varadarajan, Executive Vice President and Member of Executive Committee at Colabera Incorporated.
80 to 90% of sales managers are absolutely reviewing the wrong thing. They are reviewing numbers. I agree, the numbers are important. They are the outcomes. But they are the lag indicators. They are not the lead indicators. To me, the lead indicators are, is your salesperson really knowledgeable about the accounts he is going after or she is going after? Does she really understand the customers that she is serving? Does she understand the industry she serves? These are, to me, in leading indicators that will give you a sense that your sales team is executing and operating well. You know, what happens is sometimes a salesperson just gets lucky. She shows up and voila, she closes a deal. It's in spite of her, not because of her. And this tendency to focus on the lag indicator, which is the number, is absolutely the wrong thing to do.
Arun is the Executive Vice President and Member of Executive Committee at Colabera Incorporated. He is currently based in Princeton and has significant global experience across Asia, Middle East, Europe, and North America in building solutions, creating market relationships, establishing strong customer base, and building partner ecosystems in various leadership roles spanning sales, practice, and delivery for over 27 years. He was a serial entrepreneur for 8 years, founding member of 2 startups in the technology space that were incubated and grown rapidly. Arun has received an MBA from Stephen Ross School of Business at University of Michigan and a bachelor's degree in computer science and engineering from the College of Engineering, Guindy, Chennai. Now, on to this great episode with Arun Varadarajan. Arun, welcome to the Buyerside Chat. I'm delighted to have you on the show. What a wonderful time to catch up again.
I know, Subhanjan, it's been a long time. This is an interesting forum for us to reconnect. I think it's extremely germane to what we are going through right now. And probably have been going through for a while. Unnoticed.
Yes.
And so I do believe that, you know, as you said, as you rightly said, it is about the buyers. And it's about the sellers trying to figure out how to engage with the buyers and really support the buyers through their buying process. And I think that's the change that we're all at least hoping to make as we move forward.
Right. So Arun, you have a wealth of experience. I mean, you have worked across geographies in the most competitive markets. You are in one right now. You know this thing inside out. You have played the big boy game, you have played the startup game, you have had tremendous success in your personal endeavors. So let's get started with the core idea. Mm-hmm. Do you see and do you agree that how people used to buy and sell, say, 15 years back, I don't want to go further than that because it was obviously different.
Yes.
Is not the same as they're buying today.
Very true. I would say that. I would absolutely violently agree to that. And to me, there are, I would say, 3 reasons. One is the information asymmetry that one leveraged 15 years ago no longer exists. In fact, it's the other way around. Buyers are smarter than the sellers. The second is I think they have a lot more of choices as compared to before. Competition has really stepped up.
Right.
And I think number three is the buyers are a lot more clearer about what they want to buy. Earlier, a lot of the buying process was exploratory, trying to figure out what they should do. Today, the buyers have a far better view of their problem statement and therefore are engaging with the sellers to see if the sellers understand their problem statement and are offering them solutions to solve their problem. I think these are the three fundamental changes that I have witnessed, having been in the IT industry for 28 years and counting.
Absolutely, absolutely. When we are trying to engage with this new buyer, if I may call them so, where does this start? Do you think it starts from the point where me as a salesman, I'm trying to prepare for engaging with a buyer? But how does it start?
I think first of all, it starts with, in my opinion, it starts with really, really researching and understanding your buyer, the context that he or she is operating in. What are the challenges that the industry is facing that he or she exists within? Really understanding their imperatives. And today, the advantage that we have also as sellers is that there is great amount of research material available in the, you know, in public domains. And if you pay some money also in some, you know, in some information domains, which can really give you insights. And I am not seeing consistency amongst the sellers in really leveraging this information to understand what the buyer context is. And that's the starting point for me. So when you're getting into a selling situation, if you have that rich context in your head, you have read the 10K filings, you have read the annual report, you have listened to the last four earnings calls. These are all out there in the market, right? If they're not publicly listed, there are other ways for you to search and find information. There's Glassdoor. There are multiple tools available. Then you are in that position where you are starting with a position of emoting to the buyer. That's when I think you have a you'll have a very, very positive start to the experience. Because in my opinion, I love to borrow the PNG term, first moment of truth, right? Which is a concept in CPG marketing. The first moment of truth in that whole selling process or the buying process from the buyer side is how you are able to contextualize your conversation and emote to the buyer.
Right, right. Why do you think people are not talking about that enough? So just taking the sales side perspective, why do you think the discourse is still not focusing on this, which is a fundamental, instead of saying, oh, you should do, you know, call analysis, you should do training and you should do A, B, C, D. But I have not seen a single course out there which teaches how to research your buyer.
You are 100% right. You know, and I'll tell you the reason for that is sales managers are 90 to 80% of the sales managers. And I'll just state out there, maybe I'm going crazy on the statistics. In my opinion, having witnessed this for a long time, 80 to 90% of sales managers are absolutely reviewing the wrong thing. They're reviewing numbers. I agree, the numbers are important. They are the outcomes. But they are the lag indicators. They're not the lead indicators.
Correct.
To me, the lead indicators are, is your salesperson really knowledgeable about the accounts he is going after or she is going after? Does she really understand the customers that she is serving? Does she understand the industry she serves? These are, to me, in leading indicators that will give you a sense that your sales team is executing and operating well. You know, what happens is sometimes a salesperson just gets lucky.
Yeah.
She shows up and voila, she closes a deal. It's in spite of her, not because of her.
Exactly.
And this tendency to focus on the lag indicator, which is the number, is absolutely the wrong thing to do. So that's number one. Number two is, even today, the CRM exists only in theory. It's really not being leveraged to understand what are your sellers doing? What are they doing? What kind of call planning are they doing? Some of the basic things. So I'll tell you, I had this fantastic experience of working for a very short time for a very, very hardcore sales company called HCL. All of you know HCL. And in HCL, if you did not submit your daily sales report at the end of the day with details, right? And it included call planning. So there was call planning and there was also for you to report on the calls you made. People will go ballistic. You know, you will be in the regional manager's office in a snap. So really inculcating that discipline in the salesperson and making it part of his or her sales process, I think is not being given the attention today. Everybody is only looking at the number, the end outcome, and not the process. There's not enough focus on the process.
Absolutely.
That is why this is being ignored. And everybody's in a hurry to sell, right? They've got these widgets, they've got these hammers searching for a nail.
Right.
That is the problem.
Right. In fact, that could be an interesting topic for a later discussion. How arbit is this quota business? And we'll visit that. We'll visit that another day. But it's worth pursuing as a discussion.
It is absolutely worth pursuing because I'm telling you, I've seen it in, you know, I don't want to really provide names and quote examples, but you know, a few years ago, I realized we had a scenario where we had an opportunity to really construct a large deal. And as opposed to constructing a large deal, because there was focus for that salesperson to deliver his or her numbers in this quarter, we lost the opportunity to construct a large deal. We went with a large deal view, but large deal perspective, but a small deal focus.
Right.
When I mean by large deal, I'm not, one is of course the numbers, but what I mean by large deal construct was that there was a very large transformative proposition that we could have sold to the client that would have benefited the client significantly and of course benefited us.
Of course.
As opposed to taking that broad brush opportunity of saying, hey, here is something that I can deliver to you of significant value. We diluted and did something small, only to find another smarter seller having that conversation and taking that piece away from us, right? So this happens all the time. And that's why I feel that I have also a problem in terms of how quotas are set and how numbers are set.
Yeah.
They actually are very, very short-term focused. And therefore, in the interest of getting the deal done, they end up losing the deal because they're selling the wrong thing to the client.
Yeah.
And the client, especially today, the client says, you're doing a used car salesman on me. I am not interested in buying from you.
Yeah. And you know how many videos get posted on LinkedIn about how to pressurize the buyer to buy when you want him to buy?
How can you pressurize anyone to buy? Right? And I think that's where I think half the problem is, Shubhanjan.
Yeah.
We're really not helping our clients because at the end of the day, yes, we all obviously need to hit our numbers because if we don't hit our numbers, we're not going to be able to sustain. But I feel that rather than focus, the numbers will come. And I've seen this in my career right through. The numbers come if you do the right thing, right? If you're able to engage with your clients in that trust zone, you talked about that win-win zone, right? The win-win zone has a high overlap with the trust zone.
Yeah.
Right? Absolutely. And if you are able to operate in that trust zone, you will very quickly reach that win-win zone. And yes. That's where deals are made.
Yes.
And if you lose focus on that, I think you will end up maybe meeting some of your short-term objectives, but in the long term, you will lose. It's guaranteed.
Absolutely. So how does the salesperson actually, I mean, even if you have listened to the earning calls or even if you have looked through their annual filing and so on, you have a sense that they are moving towards implementing a new solution or opening a new plant or whatever, and you can help them there. How do you actually now go and understand what is the specific needs of this buyer and whether you're able to fulfill that?
Amazing question. Because what happens is, people don't realize this, right? When you do the research, what you are doing is basically getting to a higher degree of awareness about your client. Mm. You still don't know your client. Mm. Let me tell you that, because this is secondary information. This is information that is in the public domain. Mm. It has its limitations.
Right.
Now, they should become guardrails for initiating your discussion.
Mm.
So when you go in there, don't presuppose that these are the challenges he or she has.
Hmm.
But use that information that you have built to arrive at a set of, to arrive at a discovery process for you to really, first of all, understand, are these the real problems that he or she is facing?
Hmm.
And spend a lot of time on that and make the client talk. I'll tell you, the first sales call that you make, if you are speaking more than 30% of the time, is a shit call. Pardon my French, but it's a lousy call. I used the word, sorry.
No problem.
But it's a lousy call, right? You have to be talking less. Maybe 10, 15%, 85% is what you want the client to talk. And I've seen this time and time and again. We meet a client for the first time. We think it's the opportunity for us to, you know, throw 35, 40 slides at them as to how big and how great we are and all the services and all the offerings that we have. And the client has got complete information overload, has no clue, because you sound just like everybody else. Because let me tell you something. It is very difficult for you to differentiate in the services market through any sort of offerings or any sort of productized frameworks. Everybody has one. And most people make an absolute, mockery of this whole thing of saying, you know, we need these offerings, in my opinion, are for you to help your sales guys say, these are the kind of problems I can solve. I can't solve world hunger, but gives them direction on these are the kinds of problems you can solve. It is not for you to go and regurgitate these to your clients without context, right? So I think, like the question that you asked, the first step for the salesperson after doing the research and when he or she meets the client is to use that research for coming up with a discovery process and asking a lot of questions so that the client gets to talk about his or her problem. And in the first sales call, you probably don't even need to talk about what you can do, right? I would even table it and say, listen, at the end of the call, I've understood that these are your problems. Let me think about it. I think I have some ideas, but let me flesh it out. Let me come back to you on what are the potential strategies that we can use to solve your problem. You're still not selling yourself.
Right. Right.
That would be the first, in my opinion, the first win.
Yeah, I agree. And that's your first step towards building trust, that this guy is not trying to hustle me.
Yes.
Like the four other guys who came into my office reading the same annual reports, right?
Yeah. So I know some guys who will come and say, and I've seen this in my career, you know, when I was a sales guy in IBM in the early days, I've seen salespeople go to a customer and say, listen, I'm about 250K away from meeting my target. Can I just bill you?
Really?
I'm not kidding. And I've seen sales managers do that with their salespeople. I refused. They all used to make fun of me when I started my career in IBM, saying that, oh, this guy only wants to call on the C-level. At the end of the day, you're selling, you know, hardware. Why do you need to talk to somebody at the C-level? I said, listen, even if I'm selling hardware or whatever I'm selling, I need to understand whether the client needs that hardware. And what is he or she going to do with that hardware and software? And this was in the early 90s, I'm talking about.
Mm.
right? And I used to be, oh, this guy, he wants to. And I, those days, we didn't have access to information like we have today. Yeah. So I would read up newspapers and get articles and read the, you know, the Business Standard, the Economic Times and those kind of publications. And in India, it was even worse. You know, I'd come back to India at that time and it was very difficult to get information. So I found ways to get information, did the maximum research I could do. And I can tell you, I did two or three deals that everybody was shocked that I did just because I spent time understanding the client.
So when do you need to map out the organization? How do you suss out the fact, whether it's in this meeting or later or how, that I need to understand who all will be in this, in the map, whose voice will be important for the final decision when the time comes?
I think it is very simple. Just ask the question and you'll be amazed how clients see. First of all, as I said, once you get into that level of comfort with the client, with the buyer that you're working with, obviously, like you said, the buying organization is a complex organization. It's not one person who's making the decision. It's probably one or two people who are fronting the decision, okay, right? Now, if you get to that mode of engagement with them, which is highly listening oriented, highly problem solving oriented, highly concerned about their problems, highly, you know, that whole emotive selling process, I can tell you when you get to that point, I have found clients telling me that, listen, I'm telling you, Arun, that we need to convince these other two people as well, right? I know this is a problem. I know we have to solve this problem. There are these three other people who I think we need to convince. So normally I turn on and say, can I help you in any way?
It's time for a short break. Arun started narrating the value of emotive selling and earning trust to the point where those in the customer's team who are fronting the sale, not necessarily deciding, explained who all needs to be convinced. Arun has a great tip here. Never want to meet those other stakeholders. He will explain why after the break. Stay with us.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Right before the break, Arun started to explain how you need to empower your customers to sell the solution insight to the decision makers. Let's hear him explain.
I have found clients telling me that, listen, I'm telling you, Arun, that we need to convince these other two people as well, right? I know this is a problem. I know we have to solve this problem. There are these three other people who I think we need to convince. So normally I turn on and say, can I help you in any way, right? Can I arm you with stuff? Because the worst thing that you want to do is to tell the client, can I go and meet them? That's what most sales guys do. Most sales guys say, hey, if these three other people are also involved in the decision making, let me go. Can you introduce me to them? That's not my style. My style is to say, how can I help you convince them? You tell me. What will work best for you? I'm happy to do it whichever way you think is going to work, right? If it's me preparing material for you that you can take to your executive management, I will prepare you for that meeting. I will prepare the deck. I will rehearse with you on what we need to say. If you think it's going to add value by me being there as an independent, I mean, I know I won't be so independent, but if you think there'll be value in me being there, I'm happy to be there. Sure. That's not what I hear hustlers saying. Hustlers want to go. I know the blue sheet process, the Miller-Hyman process is a brilliant process, right? It helps you understand the buying process and who's involved in what. And there's a tendency for us to say, I need to know every one of the influencers. No, not needed. If you have a champion who's able to fight for you, then yes, why not? Empower the champion.
Fair enough. So how do you then determine when is the point when you actually start selling your solution? We have crossed two milestones, right? At this point, we have understood, possibly grasped from the buyer actually the need, and sort of connected our background research with what they have sort of let us into. And there is, we have sort of toiled to build trust, and this might be happening over several weeks or a month or two, because no B2B decision, unless it's like $100-$200 SaaS, no decision is going to get taken just like that. When do you start your actual selling?
The ideal situation, let me tell you the ideal situation, we'll come back to a pragmatic approach. The ideal situation is you have gotten to a point where the buyer actually invites you to sell. And I remember you using this fantastic phrase, which I am now borrowed. This is the permission economy, you said, right, Subhanjan?
Yes.
And I'm translating it to this. To me, the ideal scenario, and there are two deals I'm in the middle of, obviously I can't talk about it, where I know that where the buyer has invited me to sell. Yeah? The buyer says, you know what? I think you know my problem. Not I think. I know you know my problem. I know you, you know, you absolutely mean well in helping me solve this problem. Right? I'm inviting you to sell to me. That's where you want to be. Right? So you want to really drive the process to a point where the client says, give me a damn statement of work. Let's get started. So I still don't want to sell. I still want to talk about how am I solving the problems. And then if she says, listen, Arun, what kind of tool sets and what kind of services do you think we need to solve this? I can tell her these are the kind of things that we have done for others. This is what you would need. So it's still that advisory mode. And that's what, in my opinion, we should be doing if we want strategic sales.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, again, I was referring to one of these webinars that I was doing, and I said the biggest problem with selling today is perhaps the buyer is looking for strategic solutions and we are bombarding him with tactical stuff, right? So do this 30-second thing, do this 2-minute thing, and so on and so forth. So we are in a complete disconnect of what the buyer is looking for and how we are going about selling it. So let's now come back to this whole point of trust being so critical. Relationships are not being built the way it was being built, say, 20 years back, right? So 20 years back, pretty much we are selling in the same town we have grown up in. So possibly the plant manager to whom I'm selling went to the same school with me, we played, or he's coaching my son football or rugby or whatever. The trusts were being built over several years, and you know, okay, you know, Subhanjan has my back, or Arun is not going to sell me something I don't need. He will actually tell me, boss, you know what, you don't buy it, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's not happening anymore. We are selling across geographies. We are going from India to US. We are going from US to Spain or to Europe or whatever. Trust is basically maybe more on the brand than the person who is selling it to me. So break this up for me and tell me, where do you see this? Where do you see this trust actually getting built, and how is it getting built today?
So I'll tell you, I mean, it's kind of interesting. To me, when I break it down, I break it down like this. There is something known as a market reputation that you build,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is built over time. So there is a market reputation that gives you permission to play.
Right.
Right. It allows you, it gets you invited into certain buying processes. It allows you that opportunity to get there.
The access,
right? But that's all it gets. After that, it's got nothing to do with your brand. They stop thinking about whether you're from Accenture, whether you're from IBM, or whether you're from Cognizant or wherever else. They stop thinking about that. After that, it's about you. They buy from you. I have never found, again, as I said, I worked for very small brands. I've ran my own startups. I've also worked for big brands. Consistently, I've known that customers who bought, where I was involved in the sales process, bought from me. Right? Yes, they felt there was a little bit of a reassurance about the brand that I represented, but I represented some brands who were just not known. in any of these circles, right? And they would have a tough time pronouncing our company names, and they would keep making mistakes. Mm-hmm. But they would not make a mistake on, let's say, my name or whoever else was involved. So I think if we break it down, the overall brand reputation of the company only gives you permission to play. Mm-hmm. It does not give you the permission either to sell mm-hmm. or be bought. That has to be earned. And that has to be earned in the sales process, every sales process, right? Mm-hmm. So just because I sold X to Y 2 years ago, it doesn't mean that I'm going to be able to sell Z to Y. I have to again earn the trust. It is a repeated trust building model. Yeah. And I think that is what people need to understand.
Yeah, it's not like one time paid and you have got it forever.
And today, customers are willing to just change. See, they I'll tell you, these large IT transformation projects of the year have all gone out of the window because they felt it was a very restricted contract model, right? Which didn't give them the opportunity to put the incumbents on the spot. So they are now signing much smaller contracts. And because the contract sizes have gone down significantly, you have to win every time.
Right.
Meaning you have to win their confidence every time. That's what I meant by win.
Sure.
And only then are you going to be able to get them to buy from you.
I'm assuming that if you are representing a large company like you are, and you are in a large deal, mm-hmm. you will have equally large competitors trying to do the same thing. So when you get your wins, what do you think swings it towards you or away from you? It's very difficult to really win on features anymore, right?
Exactly.
So that's not going to cut it. So what is it that swings it towards or swings it away from you? What's working in the buyer's mind is that's the real question.
I think it's very simple. Are they confident that you understand their problem? Hmm. And are they confident that the solution that you are recommending to them is going to solve the problem? Hmm. It's as simple as that. And if you're not spending enough time giving them that confidence, you're going to lose or win.
So is there any illustrative story where it went either way because of this?
Oh yeah, there have been instances in the recent past where my teams assumed, right, that this was the problem that the client was trying to solve. Hmm. And we thought that, you know, this was the main, by the way, the proposition that we had was not a weak proposition. It was a strong proposition, but it was a strong proposition to not their number one problem.
Yeah.
It was a strong proposition to their number three problem. Right. So the competitor who won obviously had done much better discovery and understood that. Yes, there were three problems that they're trying to solve, but the first problem was A and not C.
Right.
Right. So you can have a complete miss there. And that's what swung it their way. So we kept harping on the fact that, hey, this is your problem, this is your problem, when it was not their A problem, it was their C problem. It was one of the problems, for sure.
But you were sort of having a confirmation bias. Because you thought that you were suited for C, and so you sort of, is that the?
All there was that bias too, because we had a better solution for C, right? Which is why I think it's very important for you to understand your position in that whole problem solving process and who you are, and an honest evaluation of yourself, right? If you do a very honest evaluation of yourself, of course, there are problems that none of us may have solved, right? Yet to be solved. But that's an open conversation with the client saying, hey, listen, these are some ideas that I have, right? We have not, it's not been done before, but we think if we apply these ideas, it'll work for you. And that's what, for example, is working right now for a few of our clients, where we're going and giving them ideas that have really not been tested, but they are definitely ideas that are resonating with them, because those ideas are completely mapped to the current challenges that they have. So when they are mapped to the current challenges that they have, and even though, so they are not buying on features, as you said, right? They're buying on the fact that, this idea that these guys have is interesting, worth a try. And my problem, I have this acute problem. So why not give it a shot? Right? And you're also building trust with the client, saying that, listen, this is still in the proof of concept stage, right? This is not completely proven out, but we have seen some good results, right? In our limited proof of concepts and pilots that we have done. I think it has legs. And I think we strongly believe that these are the kind of outcomes we can deliver for you. And that's where you have to be also willing to sign an outcome-based structure, maybe with a client, and say, hey, I'm putting my skin in the game. I believe these ideas will work. So I think that these are the few things that I find can either swing this way or that way, right? You're attacking the wrong problem because you have the best solution, as you say, and you're still biased on what you have as opposed to what the client needs. And the other thing is you're not being honest and transparent with the client in terms of new ideas that you have. So the more transparency and integrity you bring into the buying process, the more you think less about what you have and what the client needs, I think chances are the buying outcome will be a positive one.
What kind of roles do independent consultants play in complex sales? So when you're selling something really complex to a large organization, and the really independent ones, not those who are like affiliated to one vendor or the other, not like that, but independent advisors, do you see them playing a role? Do you see enough of them in enough deals?
The interesting thing is, I don't know how, you know, again, maybe I'm running the risk of saying this, but I don't know how independent these advisors are.
Sure.
Many times. And I think you said it. They have their biases without a fact, though they come in with the viewpoint that they want to bring in independence. What they do is, in my opinion, in some of them, instead of simplifying the buying process, they overcomplicate it. And they get into details that really is not in any way improving the ability of the buyer to make the decision. They can actually play a very good role, in my opinion. And I don't know enough of them that are playing that role, in my honest opinion, right? So some of these RFPs that they float are so laborious and sometimes so loaded towards size and scale, as opposed to ability to solve problems, that it completely eliminates a certain set of sellers, right? Just because somebody has, as you know, one of my clients said, you know, I used to, I was in a sales situation where my sales guy said, oh, you know, Arun runs his practice. He has 18,000 people globally or some nonsense like that, right? Which I would have never said. So the client said, I don't care about the fact that he has 18,000 people globally. I care about the 10 that are going to show up on Monday for the project.
So true.
Right?
Yeah.
So what happens with some of these so-called advisors is that they eliminate people because of size and scale. And size and scale has a meaning. Definitely. I'm not saying it doesn't, right? Do you have a good balance sheet? Can you take over costs? There are reasons for scale and size, but there are not reasons for scale and size in every scenario. So how do you make that determination as to who should come into the buying process? Should be revisited, because there could be small, nimble companies who can come in and make significant changes, agile, fast, responsive, no bureaucracy, no talking to 10 SVPs before you take a decision, right? And you need that. In today's world of digital transformation, clients are looking for nimble, agile, fast realization of benefits.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So in my opinion, sometimes small is big. Right?
Yeah.
So some of the small players can actually make a difference. So coming back to these independent advisors, I wish they think about this a little differently. In fact, one of the, one of my buddies who used to be an advisor, he came up with this concept where he said, before I start deciding who should come and who shouldn't come, I'm going to send them what is known as a request for solution, right? Mm-hmm. I've got this problem. How will you solve it? Mm-hmm. I want to see what you're thinking. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to use that to determine how I engage with you next, which I thought was a very cool idea. It didn't go, I don't think it has gone anywhere. Mm-hmm. But that's an interesting way to say, hey, who's a good problem solver?
Sure. Absolutely. So, and I think you'll see a lot more of these models emerging as it goes. And again, see, the independent advisors also are coming from the old buying, selling paradigm, right? So I think they have, like the sales folks, they have also not made that shift. And a lot of times it is like most advisors, you need to complicate a situation which you can then solve to justify your own being paid, whatever you're being paid, right? So,
correct.
So a lot of those very, very basic, I'll say 30-year-old notions still sort of carry forward. And but I just wanted to know from you how you see those roles.
I think they have to change dramatically. Long story short, the advisors and the way they engage in the process has to dramatically change.
Right.
For the buyer to make a better decision, in my view.
Right. So Arun, thank you very much. We had a wonderful time. Before I wrap up, any other thoughts? How sales folks should look at this new era, which is literally buyer-led?
Yeah, I think, it's definitely worth a conversation, another conversation, as you said, because to me, I think the important thing for sellers to realize is the less they sell, the more they will sell, right? Yeah. So I know I'm just playing with words here, but the less they sell, the more they focus on really understanding the client's problem, doing that research, because I'll tell you, it's kind of interesting. In the circumstances we are in today, I've been told by some of my clients that there are service providers who are coming and telling them, oh, can you just extend the billing for these people for another 15 days? Because, otherwise I'm going to be in trouble. And, and the client told me, listen, this guy is not coming to solve my problem. I've got problems, right? He's coming to me to solve his problem. And I think that has to change, right? And today, I think even more, what we have to understand is that our clients are going through a lot of problems and a lot of, some people don't have any revenue. Forget about revenue contraction. They have zero revenue.
Right.
And in those circumstances, I think we have to understand, we have to really understand their pain and find out how we can solve that pain. So what can we do, for example, if they have a zero revenue situation, focus on that as opposed to, again, trying to hard sell them and saying, hey, you know what? I will give you some experts. You don't pay me now. You pay me later. That's deferred payment. That is solving your problem of getting your folks busy, right?
Right.
Opposed to saying you have revenue contraction problems. What can we do to help you at this stage, right? Mm. Is there cost we can take out? Right? Mm-hmm. Is there an opportunity to re-baseline your costs? Can we improve your efficiency? Can we get you start getting prepared once recovery starts? Maybe this is not the time. Maybe we should find the time for it. So I think that is a dialogue, especially in these times. That's how I think you can differentiate yourself in the market, right?
Right.
Rather than getting pressurized. I know there'll be a lot of pressure from people like me and others on the folks on the ground saying, hey, we have to do something. Our revenue is under pressure. But how do you navigate that pressure and how do you isolate yourself from that pressure and really serve the customer is what every salesperson should look at doing. And of course, it's not easy. So
yeah, sure.
It's not easy, are the ones that doing the things that are not easy are the ways you can differentiate yourself.
The Buyer Side Chat is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink enables high-quality interactions between buyers and sellers through presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create personalized sales presentations and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversation. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 650-847-5884. That is 650-847-5884.
That's a wonderful note to end this chat on. Thank you, Arun. I really enjoyed chatting. I really learned a lot. I mean, I always look forward. I have great respect and admiration for what you have done and accomplished. And I'm so glad that that we chatted. And I'm sure, I mean, we will chat more on this.
I'm sure, Shubhanjan. And you have a wonderful podcast format. You've got some fantastic speakers. You have some very seminal ideas that I've borrowed. I'll be absolutely open with that. And I'm trying to see how we can bring it into how we are operating in the market. So, as usual, phenomenal chatting with you. Have a wonderful evening and we'll talk soon.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Coming up in the next episode is an enlightening conversation with Jens Henschel, founder and managing director of the Phibis partnership. We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of weeks. Stay tuned.
Thank you for being with us today on the Buyer Side Chat. This is the podcast of record for the buyer side journey. And those who know, that's the journey that matters. We hope this conversation helped you with insights that you can go and apply right now to your own value transaction process. See you in the next episode of the Buyer Side Chat.